This is a podcast from meow.net.
Meow!
Meanwhile, on an abandoned bookshelf.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of Abandoned Bookshelf. My name's Owen Kelly, and today I want to talk about Tools for Conviviality, a book that Ivan Illich published in 1973, and to which I have returned frequently since then. In this book, Illich argues that we don't face a political crisis, or indeed an economic crisis, rather we face a crisis in the mode of production itself, that we have just gone through a 100-year or 150-year now experiment with industrial production, and it has turned out that this experiment has failed on multiple criteria, and that it doesn't matter whether we're organised as capitalists or as socialists, the experiment has still failed. Now, in this essay, I want to use copious quotes from Illich himself and from the book, and I will string them together to form a version of the argument that he submits. In the book, he says, "I submit the concept of a multidimensional balance of human life, which can serve as a framework for evaluating man's relation to his tools. For it's that he says is the core issue, the fact that the industrial mode of production has radically altered the relationship between people and their tools in a way that is destroying liberty, freedom, and imagination." He says society can be destroyed when the growth of mass production renders the milieu hostile, when it extinguishes the free use of the natural abilities of society's members, when it isolates people from each other and locks them into a man-made shell, when it undermines the texture of community by promoting extreme social polarisation and splintering specialisation, or when the cancerous acceleration enforces social change at a rate that rules out legal, cultural and political precedents as formal guidelines to present behaviour. Corporate endeavours which thus threaten society cannot be tolerated. At this point, it becomes irrelevant whether an enterprise is nominally owned by individuals, corporations, or the state, because no form of management can make such fundamental destruction serve a social purpose. It's now difficult to imagine a modern society in which industrial growth is balanced and kept in check by several complementary, distinct and equally scientific modes of production. Our vision of the possible and the feasible is so restricted by industrial expectations that any alternative to more mass production sounds like a return to past depression or like a utopian design for noble savages. In fact, however, the vision of new possibilities requires only the recognition that scientific discoveries can be useful in at least two opposite ways. The first leads to specialisation of functions, institutionalisation of values, and centralisation of power, and turns people into the accessories of bureaucracies or machines. The second enlarges the range of each person's competence, control, and initiative, and is limited only by other individuals' claims to an equal range of power and freedom. To formulate a theory about a future society, both very modern and not dominated by industry, we will need to recognise natural scales and limits. We will have to come to admit that only within these limits can machines take the place of slaves. Beyond these limits, they lead to a new kind of serfdom. Only within limits can education fit people into a man-made environment. Beyond those limits lies the universal schoolhouse, the hospital ward, or the prison, none of which Illich finds acceptable. Only within certain limits ought politics to be concerned with the distribution of maximum industrial outputs, rather than with equal inputs of either energy or information. Once these limits are recognised, it becomes possible to articulate a triadic relationship between persons, tools, and a new collectivity. such a society in which modern technologies serve politically interrelated individuals rather than managers, I will call convivial. The idea of conviviality is central to Illich's arguments here, and as he's just said in the quotations I've given you, conviviality involves having a relationship with tools where tools assist you to add to your abilities, as opposed to tools which replace your abilities and begin to demand that you work according to their imperatives. Now, Illich identifies two watersheds in all industrial processes, and I'll illustrate them with his own example of modern medicine, the history of modern medicine. He argues that the year 1913 marks a watershed in the history of modern medicine. Around that year, a patient began to have more than a 50-50 chance that a graduate of a medical school would provide him with a specifically effective treatment, if of course he was suffering from one of the standard diseases recognised by the medical science of that time. The exclusion of mothers, aunts, uncles and other non-professionals from the care of their pregnant, abnormal, hurt, sick or dying relatives and friends resulted in new demands for medical services at a much faster rate than the medical establishment could deliver. As the value of services rose, it became almost impossible for people to care. Simultaneously, more conditions were defined as needing treatment by creating new specializations or paraprofessions to keep the tools under the control of the medical guild. At the time of the second watershed, preservation of the sick life of medical dependent people in an unhealthy environment became the principal business of the medical profession. Costly prevention and costly treatment became increasingly the privilege of those individuals who, through previous consumption of medical services, had established a claim to more of it. Access to specialists, prestige hospitals and life machines goes preferentially to those people who live in large cities where the cost of basic disease prevention, as of water treatment and pollution control, is already exceptionally high. The higher the per capita cost of prevention, the higher, paradoxically, becomes the per capita cost of treatment. Illich points out that this leads to a particularly pernicious set of consequences. The cure for bad management is more management. The cure for specialised research is more costly interdisciplinary research, just as the cure for polluted rivers is more costly non-polluting detergents. The pooling of stores of information, the building up of a knowledge stock, the attempt to overwhelm present problems by the introduction of more science is the ultimate attempt to solve a crisis by escalation. Illich argues that the existence of professionals and the dominance of professions have come to replace everyday folk wisdom, everyday common sense, in a way that leaves people trapped and unable to trust their own instincts, their own abilities, and their own knowledge. On the other hand, he argues that a convivial society should be designed to allow all its members the most autonomous action by means of tools least controlled by others. People, he says, feel joy as opposed to mere pleasure, to the extent that their activities are creative, while the growth of tools beyond a certain point increases regimentation, dependence, exploitation and impotence. Here he's using the term tool broadly enough to cover not only hardware such as drills, pots, syringes, brooms, building elements or motors, and not just large machinery like cars or power stations. He says that, "I also include among tools productive institutions such as factories that produce tangible commodities like cornflakes or electric current, and productive systems for intangible commodities such as those which produce education, health, knowledge or decisions." Illich points out that tools are intrinsic to social relationships, and that individuals relate themselves in action to society through the use of tools that they actively master, or, failing that, by tools which they are passively acted upon. To the degree that a person masters their tools, they can invest the world with meaning. To the degree that they are mastered by their tools, the shape of the tool determines their own self-images. Convivial tools are those which give each person who uses them the greatest opportunity to enrich the environment with the fruits of her or his vision. Industrial tools deny this possibility to those who use them and allow their designers to determine the meanings and expectations of others. Most tools today cannot be used in a convivial fashion. He adds that tools foster conviviality to the extent to which they can be easily used by anyone as often or as seldom as desired for the accomplishment of a purpose chosen by that user. The use of such tools by one person doesn't restrain another from using them equally. They do not require previous certification of the user. Their existence does not impose any obligation to use them. They allow the user to express their personal meaning in action. Some institutions constitute structurally convivial tools. The telephone is an example of this. Anyone can phone a person of his choice if he can afford a phone plan. If anyone keeps the lines occupied and restricts the number of personal conversations, this is a misuse of the license given to the phone company, which is given to the phone company so people can speak. The telephone lets anyone say what he wants to the person of their choice. They can conduct business, express love, or pick a quarrel. It's impossible for bureaucrats to define what people say to each other on the phone, even though they can interfere with or protect the privacy of their exchange. Most hand tools lend themselves to convivial uses, except where they're artificially restricted through some institutional arrangement or legal arrangement. And they can be restricted by becoming the monopoly of one profession. For example, dentist drills require use of a dentist license. And with libraries or laboratories placing them inside schools or other institutions which themselves require certification. Tools can also be purposely limited, as when pliers and screwdrivers become insufficient to repair modern cars. This kind of institutional monopoly or manipulation usually constitutes an abuse and changes the nature of the tool as little as the nature of the knife is changed by its abuse for murder. So we can still use screwdrivers, but we just can't use them for what we used to use them for. Your grandparents repaired their cars. My grandfather, my father, repaired his car himself using tools that he found in his toolbox. Today, that is simply not possible. And in some cases, as with cars manufactured by Tesla, it's expressly forbidden in the terms you sign when you purchase the car. Now, Illig points out that during the last few years, promoters of development have come to admit that cars, as operated now, are inefficient. And they've blamed this inefficiency on the fact that motor vehicles are designed for private ownership and not for the public good. Illig disputes this. He says that the railroads reflected class societies, even though they were established for the public good, and they reflected the class society simply by putting different fares in different carriages, despite all of them doing the same speed. However, he argues, when a society commits itself to ever higher speeds, the speedometer itself becomes an indication of social class. Fostered addiction to speed is also a means of social control. Illig wrote a separate book, Energy and Equity, in 1974, in which he looked at this. There he argues that speed is a political and not a technical problem, and that there is a maximum speed compatible with a convivial society, and that that speed is approximately the speed that is capable of being employed by a normal person on a bicycle. Bicycles, he argues, don't need highly expensive road systems. They don't impoverish people. They are very affordable. They can be made available to everybody. And they are useful for carrying people and goods. Honesty, he argues, requires us that we recognise the need to limit procreation, consumption and waste, as well as speed. And equally, we must radically reduce our expectations that machines will do our work for us or that therapists will make us learned or healthy. He specifically says that the only solution to the environmental crisis is the shared insight of people that they would be happier if they could work together and care for each other. Such an inversion of the current world view requires intellectual courage, for it exposes us to the unenlightened yet painful criticism of being not only anti-people and against economic progress, but equally against liberal education and scientific and technological advance. We must face the fact that the imbalance between man and the environment is just one of several mutually reinforcing stresses, each distorting the balance of life in a different dimension. In this view, overpopulation is the result of a distortion in the balance of learning. Dependence on affluence is the result of a radical monopoly of institutional over personal values. And faulty technology is an inexorable consequence of a transformation of means into ends. By radical monopoly, Illich means something very specific. He argues that Coca-Cola may or may not have a monopoly over the provision of beverages in a particular sports arena or whatever, but people can still buy beer or buy water. Only where Coca-Cola makes it impossible for people to buy beer or water would they have a radical monopoly. Cars, he suggests, do have this kind of radical monopoly. They monopolise traffic by preventing pedestrians, cyclists from using roads specifically designed for cars, and by encouraging the spread of real estate, the growth of out-of-town shopping malls, to the point where pedestrians and cyclists couldn't in any case get to the shops. They can shape a city in their image, practically ruling out locomotion on foot or by bicycle, as Illich notes Los Angeles has done in the mid-20th century. They can eliminate river traffic in Thailand. Illich argues that the fact that motor traffic curtails the right to walk, not that more people drive Chevys than drive Fords, constitutes the nature of radical monopoly. Illich also argues that we suffer from overprogramming. He says that the city child is born into an environment made up of systems that have a different meaning for their designers than for their clients. The inhabitants of such a city is in touch with thousands of systems, but only peripherally with each. He or she knows how to operate the television or the telephone, but their workings are hidden from them. I would argue that today, we know how to operate our computers and our phones, but the workings of those are not just hidden, but in many cases, the ways in which they are hidden from us are themselves hidden from us. Learning by primary experience is restricted to adjusting ourselves in the middle of all these packaged commodities. People feel less and less secure in doing their own thing. Cooking, courtesy, politeness and sex have become subject matters for which instruction is required. The balance of learning deteriorates. It's skewed in favour of so-called education. People know what they have been taught, but learn very little from their own doing. People come to feel they need education, not just for what we now think of as the traditional aspects of education, but also all those elements like stress and learning to sleep properly that are fundamental human rights and occur in any society, whether industrialized or not. Finally, Illich points out the extent to which polarization has happened. He argues that the present organisation of tools impels societies to grow both in population and in levels of affluence. This growth takes place at opposite ends of the privilege spectrum. The underprivileged grow in number, while the already privileged grow in affluence. The underprivileged thus strengthen their frustrating claims, while the rich defend their presumed rights and needs. Hunger and impotence lead the poor to demand rapid industrialisation, and the defence of growing luxuries push the rich into more frantic production. Power becomes polarised, frustration becomes generalised, and the alternative of greater happiness at lower affluence is pushed into the blind spot of social vision. This blind spot is the result of the broken balance of learning. People who are hooked on teaching are conditioned to be customers for everything else. They see their own personal growth as an accumulation of industrial outputs and prefer what institutions make over what they themselves can do. They repress the ability to discover reality by their own lights. The skewed balance of learning explains why the radical monopoly of commodities has become imperceptible. It does not explain, however, why people feel impotent to correct those profound disorders which they do perceive. Illich points out that new classes of under-consumers and underemployed are one of the inevitable byproducts of industrial progress. Organisation makes these under-consumers and underemployed aware of their common plight. At present, articulate minorities, often claiming the leadership of majorities, seek equal treatment. If one day, Illich argues, they were to seek equal work rather than equal pay, equal inputs rather than equal outputs, they could be the pivot of social reconstruction. Industrial society could not possibly resist a strong women's movement, for example, which would lead to the demand that people, all people without distinction, do equal work. Women are integrated into all classes and races. Most of their daily activities are performed in non-industrial ways. Industrial societies remain viable precisely because many women are there to perform those daily tasks which have resisted industrialisation. It's easier, Illich says, to imagine that the North American continent would ease the exploit of the under-industrialisation of South America than that it would cease to use its women for industry-resistant chores. In a society ruled by the standards of industrial efficiency, housework is rendered inhuman and devalued. This leads Illich to point out that the ultimate obstacle to the restructuring of society is not the lack of information about what limits are needed, nor the lack of people who would accept these limits if they became inevitable, but the power of political myths. Almost everyone in rich societies is a destructive consumer. Almost everyone is, in some way, engaged in aggression against the world. Destructive consumers constitute a numerical majority. Myth transforms them into a political one. Numerical majorities come to form a mythical voting bloc on a non-existent issue. They, in quote marks, are invoked as the unbeatable guardians of vested interest in growth. This mythical majority paralyzes political action. At closer inspection, however, they are a number of reasonable individuals, reasonable small groups. One is an ecologist who takes a jet plane to a conference on protecting the environment from further pollution. Another is an economist who knows that growing efficiency renders work increasingly scarce. He tries to create new sources of employment. Neither of them has the same interest as the slum dweller in Detroit who purchases his colour TV on time. The three belong no more to a voting bloc that would defend growth than clerks, repairmen, or salespeople who are somehow politically homogenised because each one fears for their job, needs a car, and wants medicine for their children. There can be no such thing as a majority opposed to an issue that has not arisen. A majority agitating for limits to growth is as ludicrous a concept as one demanding growth at all cost. Majorities are not created by shared ideologies. They develop out of enlightened self-interests. The most that even the best of ideologies can do is to interpret these shared interests, these self-interests, these enlightened self-interests. The stance each man or woman takes when a social problem becomes an overwhelming threat depends on two factors. The first is how a smouldering conflict erupts into a political issue demanding attention and partisan action. The second is the existence of new elites who can provide an interpretive framework or a new and hitherto unexpected realignment of interests. Now, arguably, Illich does not give us the clues we need at the end. And what I mean by that is quite simple. Illich, at the start of the book, lists a series of tasks he's not going to do. He says that he's not going to describe a future society because he doesn't want to write fantasies. And he says that he's not going to deal with political strategies or tactics because this would distract from the core of his argument. He therefore deliberately and by design doesn't tell us how we might get to there from here. His personal interest is more with how people in the global south might get there from here and bypass industrialization altogether. We, however, are here and need to get there. So we need to consider how we might do this. That is something I will want to talk about later at another point in the near future. Now that you've heard the podcast, you can go to the website to find out more details, including references and links. The website's at miaw.net. That's miaaw.net. See you there.